This podcast was made possible thanks to the generous support of Mr. David Salerno.
Hello everyone, welcome to the third episode of Liberty and Wine. Today it's a special episode where we'll be hosting Carla, who's a very key person in the Free State Project and a genuine freedom fighter. She had so much to say and it was so interesting that basically she is going to be our guest for the whole episode. But of course, it wouldn't be Liberty and Wine if we didn't do our wine review. And so I will be reviewing a bottle of 2016 Luigi Righetti Amarone. And spoiler alert, I only talk in this podcast about wines I love, and this one in particular was recommended by a friend of mine, so we will have, the usual wine review after this conversation with Carla from the Free State Project. Carla, welcome to Liberty and Wine. It's both a pleasure and an honor to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
If that's okay with you, before getting into the crust of the matter, you know, I think our listeners always like to know, you know, a bit of the history of the people that we're having as guests. And so we could start talking a bit about your youth. You were born in South Africa. You saw firsthand, you know, the injustices of apartheid. But you also lived as a child in countries as diverse as U.S., Brazil, and Sweden. I mean, it's a very rich, it seems like a very rich, interesting youth. What do you draw from that period of your life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I always say if I had to write one rule in the world, my rule would be everyone should travel. I think that going to other countries, other cultures, you know, I'm a student of history, just informs us as human beings. And really what it teaches us is that we are way more similar than we are different. And that, you know, there's mostly, you know, we're united as human beings. And so, you know, I think that, you know, having lived in all these different countries and really have seen different governments, I think my takeaway in the end is that government is generally bad. They make bad decisions. You know, you mentioned Brazil. I was there during the hyperinflation in the 90s. America in the 70s, that was the, you know, the petrol crisis and the gas crisis. And then, of course, South Africa with apartheid, which was, you know, institutionalized true systemic racism. So I love to travel. I love going to different places. I was very lucky to have such an international upbringing, of course. But, you know, again, I think as human beings, it unites us. And I think that we should be looking towards our relationship with our governments to say, how are they sort of, you know, pitting us against each other in a way that really doesn't help the human condition?
You know, sometimes it sounds like a little bit kind of kumbaya, you know, to say we are all the same and we are all united. But you're right that when you dig a little, just live a little, it's actually really true. You know, sometimes you have some of these buzzwords that are only buzzwords, but in this case, it's true. And do you have any particular specific recollection or things that, like specific anecdotes about the time when you were in South Africa? You left there, you were at what age were you?
I left when I was 24, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I actually, so the reason I traveled so much as a young person is my dad actually was a diplomat. So okay. He worked for the Foreign Service. And, you know, that, of course, gave me a lot of opportunities. But my sister, who's an occupational therapist, was actually recruited from South Africa to come work in America. And that was something that was very typical in the 90s. The education system in South Africa is exemplary, or it was at the time. And so, you know, people would be brought over on working visas to the States. My parents happened to be visiting her, heard about the green card lottery, gave me a phone call. I have a very, very distinct memory of getting mm-hmm. that phone call, yeah. Them saying, hey, there's this thing called the green card lottery. Can we enter you into it? And I was like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. Sure, whatever. You know how you are when you're a student. And so they entered me into the green card lottery. And lo and behold, maybe like 18 months later, I came back. And I swear this sounds like I'm making it up, but this is a true story. Came back from watching the movie Green Card.
Okay.
And wow. There was this massive envelope on my doorstep. And I was like, what is this? And opened it up, and it was the paperwork. And so I had won the Green Card lottery, which at the time, this was in the mid to early 90s, had, I think there were about 24 million people who applied, and they picked 25,000 a year.
Wow.
And I won a green card. And, you know, that's sort of my origin story. And I was a law student at the time at the University of Pretoria in South Africa, in Pretoria, South Africa. And, you know, my boyfriend was living with me. We were kind of like, what are we going to do? Are we going to get married? Am I going to break up? But there was one thing I very, very distinctively knew, and that was I wanted to immigrate to America. I believe in the American dream. I believe in free markets. I believe in everything that this country truly offers. And so, you know, I was like, gung-ho. I was like, I'm going to finish my law degree, and then I'm moving to America. And I did.
You had these ideas fairly early. I mean, because you already in your 20s, and maybe even before that, you started to have a sensitivity towards the ideas of liberty?
Yeah, I think so. I think growing up in a police state will always help inform that. When I was in high school, I was in a boarding school, an all-girls boarding school in Pretoria. My parents were stationed in Sweden. And this was sort of towards the end, you know, this was like the mid-80s, I guess. You know, that was towards the end of apartheid. It was right before Nelson Mandela was released in the early 90s from prison. But that time that I was in high school is really the last, you know, the last throes of apartheid and the last throes of authoritarian, you know, nationalist state. And so by way of example, one of the things that happened when I was in high school was that, you know, they had this narrative there, which we now see repeated in America, sadly, and in other countries that are sort of trending towards totalitarianism and authoritarianism. But, you know, they had the story of the terrorists. The terrorists are coming. The terrorists are coming. Now, who were the terrorists? The terrorists were basically anyone the government didn't like. So if the regime didn't like you, they would name you with these broad strokes. And so in my case, I was in high school. I was a firefighter in the school, which just basically meant if, you know, if the fire alarm went off, then, you know, we would do, you know, we would go and we'd make sure and get all the students out and stuff. And fire department, the army, and the police came into our school. This is an all-girls school, you know, a fairly fancy school in downtown Pretoria where, you know, diplomats' daughters went. And, you know, it was a good school. They detonated smoke bombs in the school without telling us, told us it was a terrorist attack. So I remember actually like leopard crawling up the stairs because I thought the school was on fire and I was responsible to go save my friends.
Right.
And when we found out afterwards that it was just a test and they were just making sure we were, you know, thoroughly prepared in the instance that it would actually happen.
Yeah.
It blew my mind. It really, that moment and that experience changed how I looked at a lot of things in life because it was such a visceral experience and it was so real and it was so terrifying that for me, I couldn't see the difference between that being something where they're preparing you for something or just literally terrorizing you, which was my experience. And so that was very informative to me. And then, of course, just traveling all over the world and sort of seeing, you know, poverty in different countries, how those things are dealt with. So, yeah, I mean, South Africa in the late 80s was, you know, it was a really interesting time and place to grow up. And I think it just fomented in me a rebellious sense, and that kind of stuck.
You became a rabble-rouser.
Yes.
When you moved to the U.S., interesting, you started a career as a lawyer, and I think fairly early you ended up, you know, working for a major company. And so that part of your life, you know, how was it? You know, how did you experience these first years in the U.S.?
Yeah, so my boyfriend at the time, we did decide to get married. We're still married 28 years later, so wow. It was a pretty good decision, I think. My husband's a techie. So he's a software engineer, and I was, of course, a lawyer. So when we were looking at where to immigrate in the States, that sort of informed our decision. So we decided that California and Silicon Valley was probably the right spot for us. We came out in 96, so that was the start of the dot-com boom. We, of course, had no idea. You know, we were yokels from Africa and arrived in San Francisco, and it was marvelous, right? One of my first jobs was at Apple Computer. I worked as a paralegal, actually, while I had to retake the bar exam. Right. So I worked at Apple. I actually worked on Steve Jobs's acquisition when they did the acquisition of Next, when he came back to Apple. From there, I was recruited to go to Logitech. You know, so I did. I ended up in Fortune 500 companies working in-house as in-house counsel. But that dot-com era, you know, when we talk about monetary policy and printing money and the bubbles and the busts and all of that, you know, we came in at the start of the bubble. And so for us, we just sort of assumed this is what America is like. Oh, right. Look, you get massages at your desk. You get free lunches. You get, you know, as much vacation as you want and all this incredible stuff. And so initially we were like, whoa, this is fantastic. And then, of course, also went through the dot-com bust, which actually is what drove me towards libertarianism, I would say, as a philosophy with a name, as opposed to just the rebel-rousing, you know, inclinations of a rebel.
Yes. I find it fascinating when you discover a political philosophy that helps you put names and concept onto your natural instinct. For me, it was quite an experience, you know, because you already feel like it, you know, you think, but you don't know the words in order to express your thinking. So when you do discover the words and the concept, I find this very exciting. So in February 2008, you moved directly. You were in New York City at that time, and you moved from New York City to New Hampshire. Minus thing is specifically in order to join the Free State Project.
Yes, that's right. So for your listeners who may not be aware, the Free State Project is basically a movement where we're trying to concentrate liberty lovers and small L libertarians, meaning anyone who identifies as libertarian, but who isn't necessarily part of the Libertarian Party itself. So we're trying to concentrate thousands, and in fact are concentrating thousands of people in New Hampshire. And so the thinking was, and this was the brainchild of Jason Sorens, who wrote a paper back then. He was a Yale graduate student, and this was in the early 2000s. And he was lamenting that libertarians or you know, free marketeers, whatever name we really want to give to it, you know, just tend to get nowhere. We have in America this national politics where we put the two parties against each other and sort of have the bread and circuses that is that entire structure. And so he wrote this paper and he said, what would happen if we put a bunch of free market libertarians in one state? Could we, if we concentrated together, actually create something, for lack of a better term, that we could call a libertarian Mecca or a liberty concentrated place so that we can show people that these ideas work? Now, we know historically that they do work. We have an example like Hong Kong, where we now see, of course, the reversals of that, right? Mm. But we do know that, you know, if you have this sort of laissez-faire approach to things, that generally it does lead to more peace and prosperity. And so the idea was, okay, let's all concentrate together. And because the dot-com bubble had burst, And I was like, what happened? Like, I was very curious. I mean, I literally had to lay off 1,000 people, including myself. And I was like, you know, this is 2000. And so I was researching online and later ran across the Free State Project and then thought, oh, I'm a very solutions driven person. And I was like, oh, I like this idea. I like an idea where there's a roadmap. And if we get smart people together, maybe we can make some kind of change. And so we had, after the dot-com bubble burst, we actually took some time off. We spent almost 3 years backpacking through Southeast Asia, India, Africa. And when we came back to the States, we had landed in New York City. I gave up my legal career, decided to go back to school and got a, you know, degree in writing, you know, because everyone should have a degree in writing. And then in 2008, from New York City, decided, you know what? Yes, let's go do this. Let's go try this in New Hampshire. And that's how we ended up here.
And you've been there ever since.
Yes.
Yeah. And I remember a friend of mine told me about this. I think probably back in 2009 or 2010. And my sentiment, I mean, I was interested in it and I was, you know, favorable to it, like philosophically speaking, but I was a bit kind of skeptical in the sense of just cultural ties, you know, that my background had been, you know, in Francophone Canada and Quebec and, you know, that my family and everything. So I just felt that it was something that wasn't for me. And so I was not like particularly interested. I was sympathetic, but I was not particularly interested. And what got me interested, I would say again, or develop a genuine interest this time, was my experience of the whole pandemic, where I saw that, you know, in my experience, yes, you could say the governments were the problem, but I have a slightly different view in that sense that I would say the problem, from what I've experienced, were my fellow citizens, in the sense that in many cases, ordinary citizens or people, you know, talking or the media or just lots of other people wanted even more restriction on liberty than what the government was doing. And in certain cases, it was the government sort of almost pushing back or trying to say, well, you know, we already have a lot of, you know, restrictions. And but there was a chorus amongst the general public of saying, you know, well, we want more restrictions. We want more government control for all sorts of reasons. And the purpose of this conversation is not to talk about COVID specifically. I have a bit of a COVID hangover. But,
who doesn't?
You know, but I guess what I'm saying is when I saw how much of a minority view I was within my own society, this is when I started to say, well, you know what? I think I rediscovered, you know, the Free State Project. And I sort of said, whether this specific project or something alike, but, you know, the notion of being able to be geographically concentrated with people that share overall my general perspective in the world would just allow me to be less conflictual, because it gets tiring to having to be in harsh debate with people that are your neighbors or your friends or your, and so anyway, so I'm not saying like, I don't think for the foreseeable future, I'm going to move to New Hampshire, but I do think that COVID emphasized the validity of something like a Free State Project.
You know, I agree. And certainly for us here, you know, New Hampshire is unique and various different ways. So one of the reasons why New Hampshire was chosen as the location for the Free State Project is originally they looked at 10 different states. And for the most part, they were looking at low tax states with fairly small populations, all the obvious things. New Hampshire won out for several reasons. One is I always like to describe it as it's like it's a little country, which appeals to me because I actually would like to see more nullification. I think the federal government is awful. And, you know, to the extent that we can get as much states' rights back into the mix or even independence is certainly something I'm interested in. So, you know, we have mountains, we have the seacoast, we have, you know, the plains, we have cities, we have rural, we have all of that. But with the COVID situation, it was really quite informative to see that our community really just went ahead and we just kind of did the things we were going to do. You know, last year we actually hosted Porkfest. I think we may have been the only event worldwide that just said, we're doing it. We're doing it the same dates we were going to do it. I invited the governor. I let him know it was a First and Second Amendment protected event, that we were going to assemble, that we had the right to assemble, that free people are allowed to move freely. And, you know, and there were no health repercussions. It was fine and all of that. But that was a testament to our community. And that was actually a testament to the notion of what we are doing here. Now, New Hampshire, of course, its state motto is live free or die. Mm. It's not what you want to be chanting at a reopen rally on the state house steps in the middle of a pandemic. Right. Doesn't play well. So I like to say we can live free and thrive, which is truly what I believe, right? More freedom leads to people being more prosperous and peaceful. So critics have said, you know, well, what happens when you concentrate together? Do you become a target? Do you, you know, all of that. But I think that the last year has actually proven that no, there is actually solidarity in those numbers. There is safety in that, right? When you're a group of people together who are, you know, willing to say thousands strong, we are going to continue with our lives. And of course, you know, America is different to Canada in the sense that, you know, we do have freer gun rights here. And, you know, I'm not saying it to sound like a badass, but, you know, it doesn't hurt when you are at a event that you're doing that is technically against, you know, orders. And you just kind of say, well, we're going to keep doing what we're doing. We're peaceful people, but, you know, we can defend ourselves should the need arise. And I think that tends to put you and your government on a more equal footing, because we know, historically speaking, of course, every time a populace is disarmed, it's generally the precursor to bad or worse things happening. And so I was really proud of us. I was really proud of our community. We are growing in leaps and bounds. I think, you know, we always used to say that we've sort of moved away from the test case sort of scenario into we are in proof of concept. We've passed that. We are living our lives here. And, you know, at least for us in our community over the last year, very little changed. We, you know, we kept doing all the events we do. We have a very robust monthly calendar that people can find. We have hundreds of events and hundreds of meetups, things from, you know, crypto and Bitcoin meetups to farmers meetups to homeschooling to unschooling to people just going, you know, to the beach. And all of that just pretty much continued. And so I was very grateful, genuinely, to be here. And, you know, having moved from New York City and having watched my friends there just slowly, seemingly going mad, you know, they didn't leave their houses. They would cross the street if they saw someone without a mask on. I mean, just really things where I was shocked at how much your milieu has an influence on how you're going to approach these things. And so, again, you know, being in New Hampshire, being here with the Free State Project just really made a difference. And I think it made a difference in terms of mental health as well, because it was a rough year for everyone, but it was less bad for us.
How many do you keep track that have officially moved to New Hampshire as part of that project? Your tally is at around what? How many thousands now, more or less?
So we have about 5,000 people who identify as Free Staters. There's a lot more, I think, who are just kind of in the woodwork, but people who are willing to sort of, you know, be on a list of rabble rousers, were about 5,000.
Switching a bit, I mean, it's related, but you've been also actively, you know, involved at expanding liberty in New Hampshire yourself. Tell us a little bit about this 2014 landmark First Amendment lawsuit that you won that basically enshrined the rights for citizens to film their encounters with the police, which I think is something that's, you know, is more and more relevant given everything that's being talked about both in Canada and the U.S. and around the world, you know, with the relationship between the police and the citizens. So what was that case, and how is this why you were named the 2014 Game-Changing Remarkable Women. That's a pretty cool title for an award anyway.
Yes, that is the reason why. So I did get arrested in 2010. It was during a late night traffic stop on a rural road. I was actually following some friends home. And long story short, I recorded the police encounter because I thought the police were acting rather strange. It seems funny now to think that, you know, we're talking 11 years ago. So in 2010, this was a actual video camera as opposed to a cell phone. But how quickly things change. And I think it's really important to note that part of the reason we are having this discussion now about police brutality and about, you know, the role of the police. And of course, you know, we all want safety and security.
Yeah,
I think when we're having
police.
These debates,
yeah. Yeah.
It's not an issue of, oh, I want mindless anarchy and violence around me. No one wants that. But what we do want is we want a system where, you know, I can say, well, I, one, trust the police, and two, yes, if they are going to act as an agent in my name, then I want them to not, you know, shoot crazy people in the chest because the guy's having a bad day, you know. So there's, if the police are acting as my agent, I want to be able to support the system and the protocols that they're following. And I don't currently. So what was important about this case is it affirmed the right to film police encounters. There was another case that had predated mine, which was the Glick case. That was also a First Circuit. So the First Circuit in America, we have 9 different circuit and they serve under the Supreme Court. So we have the Supreme Court, and then there are 9 courts under that. And those are sort of the courts of appeal that you go to right before you go to the Supreme Court. Mm. So I knew when I got arrested, I knew I was in the right. I knew that, you know, everything they were saying was nonsense. And it was quite shocking to me, I can't lie. Having been a lawyer, you know, I worked in townships in South Africa. I worked on a lot of criminal cases. We'd always been taught, you know, oh, our relationship is with the police and, you know, you could trust them and believe them. And then when I saw how much they lied in my own case, it was a jaw-dropping, shocking experience for me. So they had initially just charged me with disobeying an officer and, you know, for being cheeky. I mean, I guess I was being a bit difficult that evening. And but then they confiscated my camera. So they arrested me. They took me in, they chained me to a pole.
Wow.
They handcuffed me, you know, where they make the handcuff really tight. And so I complained, and the officer actually came over and he's like, oh, is it too tight? Here, let me check it. And then literally tightened it more.
Wow.
So it was kind of like being in a bad movie.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, this is strange. So they confiscated my camera that evening. And then when they let me go at like 3 a.m, they said, oh, we're going to keep your camera as evidence. And I was like, okay, I understand that. But then I need a receipt to prove that you took my camera. Otherwise, you know, well, how do we know? And so they refused to give me a receipt because they were going to take the camera and they were going to make it disappear. But they picked the wrong lady to pick on. And so I was like, uh-uh. And then I threw a bit of a fit. And so they charged me with wiretapping. And that was their mistake because they overreached. Now, wiretapping in the United States is a 7-year felony. And the minute they did that, I was like, you know what? I'm coming at you with every resource I can. I'm going to hire the best lawyers I can afford and let's go, right? And so we fought it for 4 years. Now, initially, after they took me to court and then dropped all the charges against me, I was so certain that I had a great case and that I had done nothing wrong and that I was in the right and that this was First Amendment protected speech. I had the right, of course, to film police officers in the execution of their public duties. So they dropped the charges and I told my lawyers, tell them I want them to reinstate the charges. I want to fight this. The judge, of course, thought I was crazy, but also I think that did give them a sense of my sense of righteousness.
Right.
And so we fought it all the way. And then they lost. The court said, yes, they were arguing, shockingly, that well, because of that Glick case that had come earlier, yes, you have a constitutional right to film police officers, but that was during broad daylight, on a common, in a park that is known for its First Amendment protected speech. But we don't think, Carla, that those same rights apply, you know, at midnight on a back road in New Hampshire. And I said,
which is weird. So I think you would think the exact opposite, actually, that it's more relevant if you're in a context where there's nobody around.
Well, both that. And of course, you don't get to say, well, the Constitution applies during daylight, but the Constitution doesn't apply at nighttime,
right,
or any of those things. And that was kind of the weak argument they were making. So the court found my camera, strangely, wasn't working. So one of the things that I say to people when I talk about this case is, even if your camera isn't working, even if your cell phone's battery is dead, it doesn't hurt to just hold it up. The thing we know now is that when police officers are recorded, for the most part, they behave better. Mm-hmm. Actually, the people who are, you know, the criminal in some cases, you know, those people tend to behave better too, right? So it puts all of us on better footing. There's various statistical studies that have come out that say, you know, it helps to protect police officers if there is a recording. Of course, you know, people lie when they get arrested as well, you know, that lying thing goes both ways. And so they affirmed the right to film police officers. And in my case, what they said, which is very topical now, is that they don't have qualified immunity. Now, qualified immunity, and the shortest way to explain it is, you know, it's the police's get out of jail free card, right? So they always make the argument that ignorance of the law is no excuse, except if you're the enforcer of the law, then it's an absolute defense. That's what qualified immunity means, is, oh, we didn't know it was illegal to say she's not allowed to film us, so don't blame us, right? And it's like, no, you should have known that that behavior was legal. So if anyone is listening to this, if you are ever arrested, if they take your camera, if they try and stop you from filming, if they tell you they have to delete the footage, they do all of these things routinely, you have a constitutional right, and you will get a pretty penny settlement at this stage, because it's firm, confirmed law now, and you are allowed to film them. You're allowed to film them under any circumstances. And in fact, we've seen, based on what's been happening over the past several years, that it is incredibly important, because the reason we are having this conversation about police reform is because for the first time in human history, we can prove that they lie,
right,
that they lie, right, about what happens. Right. And for the first time, tech is on our side,
yeah,
and we are able to prove that there is malfeasance. And so it's an exciting time. They're fighting back, of course, you know, but
But like we said also, and I think, you know, this is certainly something that, I mean, from my perspective, it's both ways. And, you know, there are a lot of good police officers that are stuck, you know, as sort of victims of people who are, you know, manipulative and who will fake a certain number of things. And, you know, I think to have transparency in the execution of their function is good for them and for, you know, the citizens. It is my understanding, although I haven't verified it specifically, but I'm pretty sure that most police corps forces in Canada actually want their officers to, you know, have cameras on them when they perform their duty. Just if we fast forward a bit, you referred to briefly to the Porcupine Freedom Festival. It's going to be in its 18th edition coming up on June 21st to 27. Tell us more a bit about this festival. What can attendees can expect? Because we do have, I mean, we've just started the show, but we have a bit of analytics of the listeners. And we have listeners in Canada. We have listeners in the U.S. We have some in the U.K. and even a very few, but a couple in Australia. And in a normal time, I don't know if it will be the case as soon as June, but in a normal time, it's very easy for Canadians to cross, you know, the border. So what is that festival, and what people, what could they expect if they attend?
Sure. So the Porcupine Freedom Festival, colloquially known as Pork Fest with a C. So that's P-O-R-C-F-E-S-T. And I always say that because some people show up and they think it's with a K and they think it's a barbecue festival. So it is not. It is a libertarian liberty festival. Why the porcupine? So the porcupine is a peaceful creature, but you don't want to mess with it. It will defend itself. So that's kind of where it comes from. We've been doing it for 18 years. It's an outreach event for the Free State Project. We do it on a campground in the beautiful White Mountains. So it's up north in Lancaster, New Hampshire. So that's quite convenient for people coming, you know, across the border from Canada. And we typically have in normal times had, you know, several people who will come from Canada. So we would love to have you guys if we can make it work. It's camping. We have a main stage where we do have, you know, a lot of speakers. We have people like Thomas Woods coming. Naomi Wolf might come. She's spoken at some of our previous events. You know, a lot of different decentralized hubs that we're doing on the campground this year. So people are setting up different little villages, for a lack of a better way to explain it. So there'll be like a woman in Liberty Village. There's the Mises Caucus. You know, the Libertarian Party will have something. We usually have a stretch where it's laughably a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, you know, they're all in the camp together. Huh. So really, it's truly, I've talked to hundreds of people who've attended over the years. And what people will say is, I didn't really get it until I came. So it's hard to put in words what it is, but truly what it is it's a week-long celebration of liberty. It's family-friendly, but it's also a party. Some people call it things like it's Burning Man for rational people. You know, it's definitely like nerdy to some extent. But basically, we just get together. People go to talks. We'll have the End Film Festival this year for the first time. But really, it's a celebration of liberty. And what does that mean? For me, that means it's a combination of both personal responsibility and having a good time, right? And it's finding that balance, because that's hard, because someone's good time is like, you know, dance music at 4 a.m, but that's the mom with little kids. That's not her good time.
Yeah.
So it really is a negotiation of what does freedom look like and how much are we all willing to work together to make something that's fun for everyone. I mean, I love it. I've organized it several times. I'm really excited for this year again. You know, I just get to go and be fabulous and give talks, and I don't have to work too hard. So it's going to be wonderful. This is the first year where the campground is entirely sold out. We're actually going to have to cap the tickets. We're not going to be able to sell them through to the event itself, which we usually do. I think we'll probably be sold out in the next week or so. And so it really has a little bit for everyone. It's very, it's fun. It's chill. It's slightly nerdy. It's a good time.
And do you have hotels within a driving distance? I'm not too much of a camping guy, I must admit.
Yeah, I am not a camping girl either. There are motels on site.
Right.
Those, of course, are sold out at this stage. But there are hotels in the area. There's and they run the gamut. So, you know, you can stay in a grand resort that, you know, we have a lot of those beautiful old resorts up in the North Country, or just, you know, rent a cabin on a lake and just drive in during the day. I believe there's still some space in the downtown there. You know, the northern part of New Hampshire is mostly geared towards tourism, so you'll be able to find a place to stay. We're also sort of encouraging, you know, people come and you have to double up, or, you know, share your RV with a few stragglers or whatever. I think the notion for this year is the more the merrier. We find that when people do come to Porkfest, it really does help inform their decision to move. It's, you know, we're community based. So the more people you can meet to sort of go, oh, you know what? Yeah, these people make sense to me. I could hang out with them. You know, I could make a life here, because that's what we're asking people to do. You know, it's not easy. It's harder than selling timeshare, right? You're literally telling people, hey, I want you to up and change your life and move from wherever you are to come to a marvelous, I mean, New Hampshire is a fantastic state. It rates highest on quality of living. It really is. I've lived and traveled all over the world, and I love it here, except in allergy season. Mm. But, you know, your ask, it's a big ask. And yeah. So the idea is come meet the people, so that you can see if this is going to make sense for you. It's not going to make sense for everyone. But here's the thing. Yeah. We're building something. I see our role as visionaries and pioneers. America's lost its way. The world has lost its way. And there are people who are going to have to say liberty and human dignity that comes from liberty is important. It's worth fighting for. We have to make a stand. We have to remind people that, you know, individualism and constitutional rights and all our inalienable rights that come, you know, from whoever they come from, depending on, you know, what you believe. But, you know, being human is special, and these things matter, and we are not owned by a state. Self-ownership is important. Someone's going to have to make that point again, and that's what we're trying to do out here for folks.
Well, on that high note, I'm going to thank you for having accepted our invitation. It was a pure delight to have you on, Carla, and we do have a website, libertyandwine.com, and as we usually do, we'll have, you know, relevant references, including to the Free State Project, so those listeners that want to learn more or about the festival or what have you, they will have all the information on our website. Take care, Carla, and we'll hopefully see each other in person at some point in the future.
Thank you so much.
Bye for now. So I'm going to tell you now about this month's wine. It's a 2006 Luigi Righetti Amarone. And so first, to position a wine through its composition as geography, it's a blend of three red grapes varieties from a small family-run Veneto wine estate, so in Italy's northeast. It dates back to 1909, so these people know their trade. The Luigi Righetti Amarone is a genuinely bold Italian red wine with a very complex nose that emphasizes dried fruit, black cherry, sweet spices, and a hint of anise. It presents an extremely rich flavor that pairs well with beef, lamb, and veal, amongst other. But you know what? I also drank it earlier today with just a little lunchbox, and I loved it. So I guess it's just a great wine, no matter how you look at it. Directly after harvest, the grapes are air-dried in a process which allows them to shrivel into raisins. The process concentrates the sugar and flavor in the grapes, producing a distinctive full body wine well suited for aging. So if you want to keep that wine, you can do so. But it's also a delight to open it now and enjoy it without further ado. Like always, the wines that we review on this podcast will be on our website with a link should you wish to buy them, and I don't take a cut or I'm not involved in the selling of these wines. It's just a passion for me, but they are available, you know, listed at libertyandwine.com. So, you know, with this episode that we've had with Carla, I felt that I wanted to conclude it with a few thoughts of my own, and hopefully that you'll reflect upon while you finish your own glass of wine. The true nature of man is to be free. I will make my point here by beginning with an extreme example. If a human is tied up and not allowed to move at all, he will die of thirst and hunger. assuming no one spoon feeds him. But in a more subtle way, liberty is the only manner in which we can live our lives meaningfully, because we draw meaning from these choices we make. In a very fundamental way, individuals must be given the space and freedom to discover what gives them meaning. This is something that's actually even confirmed by clinical psychology. The sense of accomplishment and self-esteem that we feel when we own our own decisions and take responsibility for our lives is something that cannot be given to us. It is something we must, by definition, earn ourselves. I hope you will have enjoyed listening to this third episode of my podcast, and that you will join us again on Monday, July 5th, for the next edition of Liberty and Wine. So long.